Log Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So you could just see 100,000, 600,000
deducted.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa.
He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
As the sun rises over the Arabian Sea on the coastal city of Mumbai, the day is beginning for the 10 million people who live in the crowded city slums. The Hegre family lives in the Kalava slum in this tiny 10 by 10 foot concrete room.
Mama, I'm going first.
The 60 neighbors who live on their small lane all share just four toilets and this small room for bathing. The Hegrays' three daughters, six-year-old twins Anisha and Tanisha, and 12-year-old big sister Anchal, are up early getting ready for school. Their mother, Parvati, helps get the girls and her husband, Rajesh, out the door. After their dad drops the girls off at school, he heads to his job at a security company where he earns about $200 a month. Then Parvati cleans their house, makes lunch and dinner, and performs her daily prayers. Then the most important task of all, she collects the next day's supply of water. In this slum, water only flows during a two-hour window, just once a day.
I felt that you can't come to India without experiencing what we've all heard about the poverty. But I also wanted to frame that story in such a way that it represented the truth of the people.
Anchal,
yeah.
I think this is so wonderful that you're giving me the tour guide. You speak English so well. So it wasn't just people living in slums, eating out of the trash piles and not having a place to defecate and all the stuff that comes with being extremely, extremely poor. But for me, every story is about the heart of the people. And so what is the heart of the people? How do you find a story that shows somebody who is living a life of sparseness, of poverty, but also still has the heart? Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Great. All right, we're going here?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Showers of blessings. Oh, thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you, family. Thank you. I have to tell you, when I stepped in the door, I was thinking, okay, where is the house? Okay, where's the rest of the house? And then I realized I was already in it.
Everybody quiet, please.
Okay, I wanted to start off by just saying thank you for allowing me into your home. How long have you lived in this home?
Living for 33 years.
33 years?
Yeah.
You don't look 33 years old, but you've lived here your whole life?
Yeah.
So your family was here before?
Yeah, my family is also here.
In this space?
In this space.
And this is the entire space. The entire family lives and sleeps in this space. One, two, three, four, five of you sleep in this room.
In this room.
You eat in this room. You play in this room. You share family time together in this room, which is from here to here. The five of you.
Yeah.
Okay. This may be an obvious question, and I don't mean to be offensive, but does it ever feel crowded? Does it feel crowded?
No.
It doesn't feel crowded.
No, we just manage it. We have a habit of sleeping because we don't feel anything.
You don't feel anything?
Yeah.
And how do you do it? I mean, how do you physically do it?
I sleep in that corner.
Where I am right now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she sleeps over here, my mother over here, my another sister over here, and my father over here.
Okay. All right. Would you say this is this a hard life? Is it difficult?
Yes, ma'am.
It is. Yeah. And tell me what's the most difficult thing about it.
Difficult work, tell us that mother work aayegi, my family will not be able to do it.
Means he has a problem at that he cannot manage his salary enough for four people.
Yeah. This was an arranged marriage, right?
Yeah.
It was an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it turn into a love marriage?
After 1 year, I love it.
After 1 year, you love it. Is he a good partner?
Yeah, very good partner.
Good partner.
Yeah.
Do you have a good life with him?
Yeah, very nice life.
I recently renovated this 100 square foot building into a cozy tiny home, and in this video I'll show you around and break down the cost along the way. So, let's get started. You enter the property from the side because the building is located in my garden, detached from the main house here in the east of England. I've lived in the house for 4 years, but it's currently undergoing some major renovations, so the tiny house gives me somewhere to live in the meantime. When the house is finished, I'll be renting it out, so this tiny space will serve as storage for my stuff, as I'll be moving away for a while. The extra tall fence can make the space feel darker, but will provide privacy to the tenants if ever I need to come and collect something. Now, you enter the tiny home via this lobby, which feels surprisingly spacious thanks to the wall-to-wall floor mat. When paired with these wall-hung shoe storage boxes, it really helps to maximize the space, and if they are any deeper, I'll be walking into them all the time. With the coat and key racks finishing off this space, and the total cost of everything in this room, from the floor mat, the shoe storage, and the coat rack, was just £121. Not a bad start for this budget build, which I gave myself around £8,500 for. Now, as we take the long walk into the bathroom, it's worth mentioning that there was no running water in this building at all when the renovation started, so that was a significant extra cost.
Now, of course, this is a small bathroom, but the shower feels incredibly spacious, and this wall was actually moved back in order to achieve this,
which allows for a much more relaxing shower for someone as tall as me, and much more legroom when using the loo. The cost of this room was just over £1,100 in materials and £4,000 in labour, for a total of £5,124, which is where the majority of the budget for this entire renovation went. But you may have noticed there's no sink, which means washing your hands in the kitchen. A small space calls for a small kitchen, and that's exactly what I have done here. But despite that, there's still plenty of room to store, prep, and cook food at home. There's no oven in here, but I rarely use one anyway, and this 4-burner cooktop is more than enough to cook all of my meals, and the microwave is great for reheating any leftovers. The angled extractor fan is compact, which allows me to see what I'm cooking, whilst a smaller fridge allows room on top and down the sides to store more things. Now, I think upgrading this toaster to an air fryer would be a huge upgrade for this kitchen, but I want to know what you think, so let me know in the comments below what you think would be the biggest upgrade to this kitchen. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention that these two walls are magnetic whiteboards, which I use all the time to make notes, plan my days, and make lists of things I need to do. To heat the space, I use this electric radiator, because I didn't want to run any gas lines into the property, as that would have massively increased cost. As for keeping it cool, I just have to open the window and the door, and the place will cool down within minutes. The cost of this kitchen is a little more complicated, because I had the Worked Up and Splashback already from a different project. I also got a few things from Facebook Marketplace to help keep the cost down, such as the cooktop, extractor fan, and even the tap. In total though, it cost me just under £1,300, and if you added a little bit more for the bits I got for free, you could look to spend around £1,700 in order to achieve a similar look. Finishing off the kitchen, I have this floor-to-ceiling cupboard, which stores the majority of my possessions. Paring down from a 3-bed house to a 7-shelf cupboard did take some time, but it was something I was going to need to do anyway before the end of the year when I move away. And now we get to where I spend most of my days, the office. I wanted this area to feel more luxurious and professional, as I knew I'd be spending the majority of my time here, as a software engineer during the day and a wannabe YouTuber at night. So that's why I chose to make the desk out of a piece of solid oak from an old dining table which I found on Facebook Marketplace, which, when combined with the sit-stand desk frame, gives a lot of flexibility when working. The dual monitors are mounted to this stand, which looks much cleaner than just keeping them both on the desk, and more importantly, it provides a lot more space for everything else. This space will be getting even cleaner soon too, as this PC has just been replaced by my new personal laptop, which is a significant upgrade over my 12-year-old PC. And the reason I could afford this upgrade is because of you. By watching my previous video and subscribing, I managed to unlock monetization, and with that first video pay slip, I upgraded my setup in order to make better videos. So if you have enjoyed this video so far, please consider subscribing, pressing the bell icon, and why not like the video while you're down there too? It's really helping the channel a lot in these early days. Thank you. As for the cost of everything in this office, I spent just £301. Now, I know what a lot of you are thinking. Why did I use such a dark color in this tiny space? And look, I get it. This was the first space I ever designed myself from start to finish, and I learned a lot about interior design along the way. However, even after living in here for 6 months, I still absolutely love this blue. It may not be for everybody, but for me, it works, and it's never made the space feel claustrophobic at all. If I'm not out and about, this is where I spend most of my evenings. And whilst I don't use the sofa in this mode too much, when it's set up as a recliner, it becomes a perfect hangout space for relaxing, playing games, and watching TV. Speaking of, I have this 49-inch LG TV mounted to the wall, which may seem like it's at a terrible viewing angle, but it is actually on this extendable mount, so the entire TV pulls out and rotates 90 degrees so that you can see it while sitting on the sofa. In fact, you can rotate this TV any way you like. You can watch TV whilst cooking, washing up, or even on the toilet. The wall-mounted PS4 behind the TV ensured that minimal space was used, whilst allowing me to be always just a click of a button away from jumping into some games. To transform this space into a bedroom, I simply have to pull out the sofa, set up the legs, and lay the back on the floor. This gives me about a small double bed in total. I fit. Right? So how much did this all cost? Well, I came into this with a budget of £8,500, and looking back at the kitchen, bathroom, and everything else we've seen so far, they all came to a total of just under £6,700. And when you add in the near £1,200 for the living room section, the total so far comes to £7,870. And that leaves just the miscellaneous section, which includes things like the fencing, electrics, and anything else that didn't naturally fit into any of the other categories. And in total, that came to just under £2,400. Leading to a grand total of £10,241. I'll admit it's a little bit over budget, but by doing the work myself, I helped keep that cost from getting even more out of control. So that leaves one more question. Was it worth it? Well, I've actually lived here now for 6 months, and I'm really enjoying being in this space. But besides being just somewhere for me to live whilst the house gets renovated, I actually had the whole house evaluated before and after I did this renovation, and the number surprised me. For what cost me £10,000 to renovate, it added £30,000 of value to the house, which was far more than I ever expected. I thought maybe I'd get the money that I invested into it back, but to see that it tripled my investment blew my mind. There are some links in the description below to a lot of the products you've seen throughout this video. And if you want to actually see me transform this space from start to finish, then click right here or here to see that video, because not everything went to plan. And with that, please consider liking the video, subscribing to the channel if you're new around here, and I will see you next time.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing, right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself, right? And so like if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right? And you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food. They are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you. And that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now, here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there are things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had 7 boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat 2, 3, or 4 sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars. Right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times, we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means like they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent, okay? So, but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian, like, it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17, why, the answer was always going to be the same. Because I said so. Right? So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay? Because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from, is present, pursued, I don't think I spelled that right, pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now will cause me to value that thing, and so I've got a value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time, and he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town, and then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one, is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know, pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road. And I'll take some time off of playing golf. And I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. okay? That gives, okay, she'll be four in July, so that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be, oh, snap, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking. Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake. Then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's, but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, oh, look at him. Is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you what I'm willing, my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow, and they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids or how to win their present pursued victories or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all tracking? Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1, and I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why, like if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one, but I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many of y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer and you make an offer to that person and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what you have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say, I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. If you just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a level of wealth, but a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by, I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell. They're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is, if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication, on the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication, okay? So communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity, right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it, right? Okay. Well, so communication. On this level, low end, you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance, right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, you might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, We got, we have, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once, just get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like, I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of, I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 155, 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay, so, or you might, or these people are coaches and teachers and actors and songwriters and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one, and YouTubers. It's crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like YouTube? I had no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2022. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, this is how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization. Did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos. Hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months. Turned on monetization, and we got paid $305. And Zach's like, we made $305 last month. And I said, for what? Because somewhere along the line, I communicated a message somebody wanted to see, and Google or YouTube was able to sell an ad on that. We're talking about 100, 200, this is amazing. I looked at it yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen, so I didn't do it for this reason. Are you all tracking? What I'm about to tell you, I did not do for the reason I'm about to tell you what happened, okay? So we started doing YouTube videos intentionally April 1st last year. I looked at it yesterday. In the last 365 days, as of yesterday, we made $289,000 that YouTube paid us. I didn't know they were going to do that. No, you don't understand. I had no idea they were going to do that. Like, that wasn't why I did it. I mean, it was a nice side benefit, right? I've never had a job where I made $280,000 in my life. Most I've ever made at a job is $30,000, ever, as a full-grown man with a family. And YouTube paid me $289,000 for turning on a camera and running my mouth. Where the camera? Turn on the camera. I got something to say. The highest level of value is imagination. It still blows my mind. The resource you use at this level is your mind and your money to make money, to create value for other people. And what happens is at this level, on the low end, you're going to make $1 million. On the high end, it could be billions. And I know that sounds crazy. There's one YouTuber. This dude has 150 million subscribers. He gets over 100 million views a month. 100 million views. If he only makes $2 a view, that's 200 million a month. Are y'all tracking? It's just the whole world that we live in is kind of insanical. It's kind of the combination of insane and maniacal put together. We can fight to stay down here, and people will do it too, because everything you do down here is hard. But I don't know if anything's harder than this, than thinking. Thinking is the hardest work most people never do. In fact, I believe that most people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they can maintain a state of mental laziness. They will work hard at what's not working so they don't have to think about what would work. They will maintain a state of physical diligence, like working their fingers to the bone, sweat, blood, tears, so they don't have to think about what would work. So they can maintain a state of mental laziness. Most people are so mentally lazy, it's pathetic. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Myron, I don't know what Bible you've been reading. I did not see that in chapter 1. Okay, I'm going to read it to you. It's kind of mind-blowing. So a couple things. One is that Genesis chapter 1, I believe, if all God wanted us to know from Genesis chapter 1 was that he created everything, Genesis chapter 1 could have been Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then he starts going into all this detail. And the earth was without form and void and darkness upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. Like, what is all that about? Well, the first thing God tells about God is not that he is love, even though he's love. It's not that he's holy, even though he's holy. The first thing that God tells about God is not that he's omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, even though he is all those things. The first thing God tells about God is that he's creative. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What's the first thing God tells about us? The first thing he tells about us is that he created us in his image, which means he created us to create stuff and he made us to make stuff. What does that mean? What that means is when God created everything, after he created everything, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. After he did it, then he went back and documented the process, so when we got ready to create value for someone else, we'd have a pattern. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That was his intention. And the earth was without form. That word was not, used to be, it became, without form and void. So disruption always follows intention. And darkness upon the face of the deep. So when disruption comes, it comes in the form of devoidness, deformity, and darkness. Like things get broken. Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that...
Oops, almost played that again. All right, today, picking up from yesterday, turning a $120,000 liability into a $1 million asset. Once again, turning $100,000, $120,000 liability into a $1 million asset. This is a continuation from yesterday's live stream. And to start off, before we open our mic here, that three words, asset, liabilities, and opportunities, they're all mindsets. Because just like beauty, it's all in the mind of the beholder. So, for some people, what could appear to be a liability, for other people, it could be an opportunity. They look at it, see it as an opportunity. For other people, they see it as an opportunity that they can turn it into an asset. Because yesterday we started off how to turn liabilities into assets. Well, this is a continuation. So picking up, let me see how we're going to do this. Before we go to the phone lines of Reba and anybody else, let's see, I'm just trying to get my board straight here. Part of the topics we're going to talk about today is how to turn expenses into income and... like I say, for the title of today's podcast, we're getting specific, more specific today, how to take a $120,000 debt or a liability and how to turn it into a $1 million asset. All right, so what we will do, we'll be back in 2 minutes with that.
Brazil has been the world's largest coffee producer for over 150 years. In this video, we will look at the history of coffee in Brazil. We will touch on its early days under Portuguese influence, the scars left by slavery, and the diversity brought by Japanese immigrants and others who toiled on its plantations. We will discuss the era of the coffee barons and how their legacy is etched into the fabric of today's industry. Our journey will reveal how coffee became a cultural icon and an economic powerhouse in Brazil. Legend has it that the Portuguese, eager to partake in the burgeoning coffee trade, were thwarted by the refusal of French Guiana's governor to export the precious seeds. In a twist of fate, Francisco de Melo Paleta, a Portuguese lieutenant colonel, was commissioned to French Guiana to mediate a territorial conflict. It was during this diplomatic endeavor that Paleta ingeniously secured coffee seeds, which he subsequently introduced to Brazil. The narrative goes that after a diplomatic assembly in 1727, the governor's wife of French Guiana, charmed by Paleta, discreetly presented him with a bouquet laced with coffee seeds. This covert exchange was motivated by Portugal's strategic ambition to cultivate a commodity that was rapidly reshaping international commerce. Understanding that Brazil's climate and terrain were ideal for coffee cultivation, the Portuguese foresaw the opportunity to dominate a burgeoning market. They were keenly aware of coffee's growing popularity in Europe, where it was becoming a staple in social settings like coffee houses, and was increasingly in demand by the burgeoning middle class. By introducing coffee to Brazil, the Portuguese aimed to replicate the agricultural success seen on other colonial plantations, and to secure a foothold in the profitable coffee trade. This move would eventually turn Brazil into a coffee powerhouse, profoundly shaping its economy and society in the centuries to follow. The growth of these plantations coincided with the decline of sugar's dominance in Brazilian exports. Coffee began to fill the vacuum, offering plantation owners a high-profit alternative. However, this economic opportunity brought with it a reliance on slave labor. Enslaved Africans were brought to Brazil in large numbers to provide the labor needed to plant, maintain, and harvest the coffee crops. Their expertise in agriculture and their forced labor were pivotal in establishing Brazil's coffee industry during these early years. The conditions on the coffee plantations were brutal. Enslaved workers faced long hours, hard work, and severe punishments. Despite the harshness of their circumstances, the knowledge and skills of these workers were essential to the success of the plantations. They knew the land, understood the seasons, and implemented cultivation techniques that maximized yield. By the mid-19th century, coffee had become the economic backbone of Brazil, with the country becoming the prime coffee supplier to a caffeine-hungry world. The wealth generated by the coffee industry began to alter the social and political landscape of Brazil, giving rise to a class of coffee barons who wielded significant influence and power. These barons would invest in infrastructure, such as railroads, to transport coffee beans to ports, which in turn facilitated the growth of urban centers. It's important to note that this growth was not sustainable without significant social and environmental costs. The demand for more land for coffee plantations led to deforestation and other environmental changes, while the social structure was heavily stratified.
Oh, okay. Oh, that audio ran out on us. Okay, today we're talking about turning a $120,000 liability into $1 million, I'm going to say $1 million per year asset. So let's open up the phone lines here. 773, your mic is open. You might have stepped away from the phone line, so I'm going to leave their mic open. Well, we go to 347. Your mic is open.
Hey, how you doing, L.A.? It's me, Dal, from New York. Apologies for
yesterday. How you doing, Dal?
Apologies for today. And I apologize a day early for tomorrow. I have a visit from Florida. You know, I'm studying IT, you know, it's called like a certified cloud practitioner. I'm studying it. I'm doing some other things like Google Cloud and, you know, different platforms like Azure and stuff. I'm learning this stuff. So I have a visitor from out of town. They came like they came in like the 8th. So that's why I was, you know, late coming into class, and then we was up late last night online because we do a lot of our study online from all over the country and all over the world. That's what we doing with that, you know.
All right, no problem.
Yeah, so that's why I was late coming in today. I woke up 8 o'clock and then I dozed back out like 11:30. Let me see if he's still on. Okay, let me see if the show's still on. Okay. But tomorrow I got to drop off to LaGuardia Airport, so I'm gonna kind of like be late in class as class is still going on.
Okay.
I'll be coming
right
on the show.
No
I'll
problem.
See you tomorrow. Late. Okay. All right.
All right. No problem. No problem. Let's see. Reba, are you there? Okay. I left my mic open. All right. Well, the picking up from yesterday, all right, we identified a $120,000 debt. And that might be intimidating to a lot of people, but what's his name? Dr. Robert Schuller, may he rest in peace. He had a saying, he had a philosophy called possibility thinking. And he would say, his motto was inch by inch. He's probably not the first one to say it, but inch by inch, anything is a cinch. So, matter of fact, I'm going to replay something on Steve Harvey, then we're going to We're going to look, because if Uncle Steve can do it, we can do it. So I'm going to pray this, and then I'm going to get back into turning, how to turn a liability, in this case, $120,000 liability, into an asset.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005, and my accountant had gotten in cahoots. And next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like,
you could just see 100,000,
600,000
yeah, you're looking
deducted.
At yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was, my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind.
Okay, so Steve Harvey was paying $650,000 a month. Some people don't earn that in 10 years. Okay. But he was paying $650,000 a month, which means he had to bring in more than that because he had other expenses as well. So, as in the title of our podcast today, turning $120,000 liability into $1 million a year business. Now, before I go to the phone lines from Reba here, let's just break that down. Let's take Steve figures first. Okay, $650,000. Let me get my calculator. $650,000 a month. All right. Let's just break that down. That's if we break it down in 30 days, he would have to bring in $21,666. Okay, a day. All right. $21,600. This is rounded up, $22,000 a day. All right. So the figure that we're going to be dealing with here, and this is in real time too, is because we have 180-day to 270-day challenge, which we'll go back into tomorrow and Friday. But $120,000. So let's say you have a debt of $120,000, and you don't know how to go, you're going to pay it off. That's just why this continuation from yesterday. So let's take $120,000, and let's divide that into24 days out of a 30-day month. Now, what that is that's if you're working Monday through, if you do something that generates income, because we're talking about generational wealth mathematics. If you owe $120,000 and you get these legal letters from lawyers in the courthouse and all that, it appears like you have a legal problem, but what you really have is a mathematics problem. Your third grade arithmetic teacher can help you out of this. All right, so let's just break this down. You owe $120,000 debt total. Now, if you, I'm going to give you a formula here, because one of the books that I recommended is Barron's Dictionary of Mathematics. One of the terms that you will find in there, in a mathematical dictionary, is formula. All right? I'm going to give you a formula that we've mentioned on here before. 781. Now, 781 is a formula that you can use, okay, to extinguish $120,000 debt. And we're talking about extinguish it within a month, within 30 days. All right, now let's break this down. 120, now, so, because that's intimidating to most people. They're afraid of it. You know, some people don't even make that in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. All right, matter of fact, let's just break that down. 120,000 divided by, let's say, 4 or 5 years. That's $24,000 a year. Some people, it might take them 5 years, you know, 5 years to make that kind of money. All right. So let's break that down into 24 days out of a 30-day month. So $120,000 divided by 24, that's $5,000 a day. Now, $5,000, that's a figure that a lot of people can wrap their head around. And matter of fact, let me cue it up while I'm talking. But we played on here before, Solar Cabin, where Lamar Alexander, he built a cabin for $5,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $5,000 to electrify with using solar panels and that type of thing. All right, that's what he did, $5,000. So let's say, and he built it by himself now. So let's say, matter of fact, let's just play this real quick before we go to the phone lines here.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14, downstairs.
All right, Lamar spent $2,000 to build the cabin, and then later on in the audio, he totaled $5,000 with, that includes, because, you know, he needed it powered with solar energy. So he doesn't get electric bills or whatever. So he can have his cell phone, flat screen TV, toaster, all that other stuff that you need electric for. So now, so let's take the figure of $5,000 and let's go with the math formula 781. 781 stands for if you have 7 people, because Lamar did what he did by himself. So if he had 7 people and it took him 2 weeks to do that, all right, which isn't bad for one person. Excellent, actually, for one person. Now, but if you had 7 people in 8 hours, you can build a tiny house. That is a definite mathematical formula. 781. And you put a value on that place at $5,000. All right. If you did that 6 days a week, that's $30,000. And times 4, you do it every week for a month, taking Sundays off, you've got $120,000. All right. Now, tomorrow, we're going to even get into more details of this because we started late today. And anyway, that's why we're taking our time on this. But I just want you to absorb that. you can extinguish a $120,000 debt within 30 days if you just have the right formula. Is 781 the only formula, mathematical formula? No. That's just one. Matter of fact, tomorrow we're going to go into deeper details on this. So tomorrow we shall be doing part two of turning a $120,000 liability into a $1 million asset. Right, so we'll be following up on same program notes as today, with a little bit more detail. But I just want you to write it down, 781. That's the math formula. Seven people, 8 hours, can build you one tiny house that will probably be worth more than $5,000, but not probably will be. But I'm just saying, it's that simple. And if you do it 6 days a week, that's $30,000 a week. And cabins that you got that you can resell, $120,000 in a month. This is doable by anybody within the sound of my voice. On that note, see you tomorrow with part two of turning $120,000 liability into a $1 million a year asset.